Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Live from Las Vegas, it's time for you to be Talking Movies with America's most award-winning film critic, John Barber.
You're being so gentle. I've heard you give reviews and you're so rough, you're saying.
How would you have evaluated your own work in some of the films that you did prior to The Longest Shot? I
mean, much better than you, my friend.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Welcome to another fabulous Talking Movies. This time we're going to be talking to Joe McBride about the fabulous Coen brothers. Doug, how are you today? And have you ever heard of the Coen brothers, who are by far the most and probably the only successful brother writing, producing, directing team?
I've heard of them more than I've heard of any other. Hi, John. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Well, I must tell you, first of all, a really big compliment to you, because we finished the interview with Joe McBride the other day, and I sent you a bunch of pictures. You added the pictures magnificently, which really enhances the interview a lot. And then you surprised me. Do you remember Silence of the Lamb, Hannibal Lecter, Anthony Perkins?
One of the greatest movies ever.
And one of the greatest villains ever. But that villain was taught by Old Country, No Country for Old Men. Did you see that film?
Oh, another great film.
Oh, my God. Well, you and the guy's name is Bardem. The greatest heavy I have ever seen in a movie. And the way you inserted him in the interview with Joe today is just absolutely fantastic. So I want to thank you so much for that. So now let's get to Joe McBride. Oh, my God. I can't tell you, Joe, how thankful I am that you are here to talk to me now about the Coen brothers, because they indeed are two of my favorites. And I know how monumentally swamped you are, but could I ask you why, with the Coen brothers as the subject, you put yourself out there in Monument Valley or wherever you are?
Well, my favorite director is John Ford, who established Monument Valley as a film site, but it's also the opening shot of The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the Coen brothers' last film together. And it's, you know, you see Buster Scruggs riding through Monument Valley, and he's singing, and it's the classic Western setting.
Well, you are a classic writer. The book, The Whole Darn Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers, is going to be an absolutely fantastic read. The wonderful thing about the Coen brothers to me is their fingerprints are all over their films. You can identify those guys just by the wonderful work they do and that wonderfully warped sense of humor. But you as a writer are monumentally surprising, because whether you're writing about John Ford or William Wyler, or even your favorite, I guess, Orson Welles, the reading of your work about their films is as entertaining as watching the films themselves.
Thank you.
And I've got to tell you, I always learned something absolutely, totally new from you at the very beginning, because my very, very favorite Christmas movie, you know what I'm going to say, of all time, is that wonderfully warped, filthy, but funny Bad Santa. I always thought Bad Santa was as good as it was because I mistakenly thought it was written by Billy Bob Thornton, And now I understand it was written by the Coen brothers.
Well, they were executive producers, but maybe they dabbled in, with the script, but they were executive producers, but not writers of the film.
Well, can you imagine the Coen brothers being executive producers of any movie and not having a hand in some of the dialogue in it?
Yeah.
So, like you, I am interested in the beginnings of everything. Do you think Joel and Ethan were born and destined to be filmmakers?
Well, they were kid filmmakers like Steven Spielberg, in Minneapolis where the Coens grew up. They were making little films that were takeoffs on big Hollywood films, and they were kind of warped satires, apparently, although we haven't seen them. But from the descriptions, it sounded like they were doing their genre parodies even as little boys. And they were watching a lot of movies. They said they liked Sergio Leone more than John Wayne, for example. They thought John Wayne was square, but they liked Once Upon a Time in the West, shot here in Monument Valley, because they said it was a strange film. They liked strange takes on genres.
What was the first thing that drew you to the Coen brothers? First, the band, and then what made you decide to do such tremendous research and write so lovingly about them?
Thank you. I was trying to remember back. I think Fargo really grabbed me. And, I actually had a little bit of a problem with Fargo when I first saw it, because I'm from Milwaukee and the Coens are from Minneapolis. And they were kind of making fun of the Midwestern dialect and way of talking, like, hello, where are the groceries, hon, I thought this was a little insulting, because there's kind of a tendency to make fun of what they call the flyover parts of the country. There's a kind of condescension toward it. But then I went back home to Milwaukee for Christmas, I guess it was, and I found that all my relatives there just loved the film, and they said, oh, isn't it wonderful that people like us are on the screen and they talk just like us, and it's just great, And I kind of thought, oh, this is actually sort of a loving homage to their roots that they grew up. They were a little alienated from the Midwestern ethos, being Jewish outsiders in Minneapolis. They said that was kind of a strange feeling. It was kind of, little community on the fringes of Minneapolis, and they dealt with that in A Serious Man, a whole film made in Minneapolis all about a Jewish man who's beset with all kinds of problems, including anti-Semitic neighbors. And
but why on earth would the Coen brothers feel that way about this magnificent industry started by Jewish haberdashers?
Yeah. They love movies, but they've never quite been in the mainstream of Hollywood filmmaking. Most of their funding in recent years, at least, has come from Europe. They're more popular in France than they are in America. They make such quirky films. Hollywood today tends to make films that are very safe and pre-tested genre films, sequels, franchise movies, and the Coens don't do that. Every Coen Brothers movie is different from all the other ones they've made, so it's hard to predict what they're going to do. And they've made a couple films that are big hits. True Grit made a lot of money, and Fargo, for example, did well, but it was more on home video. Like Big Lebowski was another one that wasn't a gigantic hit at the box office, but it caught on as a cult movie on home video. So they're not exactly mainstream Hollywood guys, and they really kind of loathe Hollywood to some extent. If you look at Barton Fink, which is depicting
love that film. Yeah. But are you kidding? But in Fargo, I get very nervous and very squeamish at that scene. I don't know where they chop up wood or something.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that is so tough. But to me, they stand out no matter where they are. I think even before I was a critic, I stumbled upon Raising Arizona. And I thought, my God, whoever did this is terrific.
Yeah, they certainly had a distinctive voice. And even before that, Blood Simple, they that was a very low budget film, and they cobbled that together with money from investors in Minnesota. And but that was a kind of in the classic film noir tradition. But Racing Arizona was really distinctive in the sense of the way they blend comedy and violence, and it's controversial. And one thing I do in my book, The Holder and Human Comedy, about them is I answer their critics, and I sort of structure the book around objections that people make to them, because even though they're you know, they win Oscars and they get Cannes Film Festival awards and a lot of critics love them, there are a lot of detractors out there, and I think that they're misunderstood to some extent. So I think it's a good rhetorical strategy, but it's a way of kind of defining who they are and who they aren't. For example, some people say they're nihilists or misanthropes or juvenile mockers, you know, glib, et cetera. And I don't think so. I think they go a lot deeper. To me, they're the sons of Billy Wilder. You know, I just wrote a book on Billy Wilder too, that came out in the fall, and Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge. But they're in that tradition of social satire. And Wilder also blended comedy and serious drama in daring ways that offended some people, because a lot of Americans don't like things mixed up. In Europe, they're more kind of
But the thing is, that's what life is.
Yeah.
Comedy and tragedy, for crying out loud.
Exactly. I often quote to my screenwriting students the thing John Lennon said, which I think is a good motto for screenwriters. He said, life is what happens when you're making other plans.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
I mean, that is truly, truly brilliant.
Yeah, you're doing something that you think is serious, and then something comical happens to you, or vice versa, and you just have to deal with it. And Billy Wilder in The Apartment, he and I.L. Diamond, his co-writer, they had a scene where Jack Lemmon finds out that Shirley MacLaine is having sex with his boss, and he's very upset, and he goes and gets drunk on Christmas Eve and picks up a drunken, goofy woman and takes her back to his apartment. And it's all sort of farcical but sad in a way. But then he finds out that MacLaine has overdosed in his apartment, and he has to get rid of his pickup. It's comedy and drama literally intersecting and in a very daring way. And they said if that scene worked, the film would work, but if it didn't work, it might not. But the Coen brothers do things that are as daring as that. Like, for example, you mentioned the wood chipper scenes where they're feeding people into the wood chipper. It's really ghastly.
It
starts out as kind of a larky comedy with this kind of wacky guy played by William H. Macy, Jerry Lundegaard, who's foolish, but you kind of like him anyway, but he does just terribly stupid things. And he thinks he can get away with hiring a couple guys to kidnap his wife and get money out of her father, which is idiotic. But the Coens, they love their idiotic characters, because we're all kind of idiots at some level underneath everything else. And I it took me a little while to catch on to the Coen brothers, I think, because they are very distinctive and different. And Fargo, at first I thought it was funnier than grim. And then you really catch on to how dark and grim the film is, because the surface is kind of larky and fun. And Marge Gunderson is such a wonderful character, played by Frances McDormand, the police chief.
One of the brothers marry her?
Yeah. She's married to Joel Coen, and she's in his recent film, The Tragedy of Macbeth, playing Lady Macbeth opposite Denzel Washington. And the Coens are taking a hiatus from working together right now, and we'll see how long that lasts. I don't know if it's permanent or not. They don't know themselves. Ethan apparently wants to go off and work on plays, which he's done before, and other forms of writing. And Joel made the Macbeth film on his own. I guess Ethan didn't have any interest in that particular project. But Frances McDormand is in several of their films, and she's a great actress. But she's perhaps their most lovable character, and that's one reason Fargo is a beloved film, I think.
Well, I tuned into them right away. And I guess I tuned into them right away because coming from a tough background, I had to turn that terrible shit into funny fertilizer. Which they seem to do in their film. So I latched on them to them immediately. And also another movie of theirs that I watch every time it comes on. Every time a Coen Brothers movie comes on, I will stop and watch. As a matter of fact, about 4 days ago, I think it came back on Showtime or HBO, which I think you mentioned it earlier, Blood Simple.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten how effective and scary that film was.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it's a scary film. It's disturbing. It's a little more straight disturbing than some of their other films where it mixes things up, you know, because there are some sweet, funny scenes in Fargo, and then there's some ghastly, grisly scenes. You know, it's Barton Fink is a horrific film about Hollywood, but it's kind of funny in a black humor way, like Kafka or Nathaniel West is.
Exactly. That's why I love it, because it's about to writers. But then also look at The Big Lebowski. Has Jeff Bridges ever been more adorable than film?
He's so great, and he's just so iconic and wonderful as the perpetually stoned guy. But he's kind of a takeoff on Philip Marlowe. You know, the Coen brothers, I mentioned they like Hollywood genre films that they like to make fun of, but they said that their main influences are not movies, they're writers. The writers that they're influenced by the most are Raymond Chandler and Flannery O'Connor and a couple of other writers. And they like people who are trenchant, you know, that you can see the mystery influence in Raymond Chandler. Big Lebowski is kind of like a Raymond Chandler movie for, you know, the modern era with a kind of a stone guy. But Chandler's Philip Marlowe was a man of honor and decency, kind of like the dude is. He's a good-natured, honest guy in the midst of all these dangerous, crazy characters like Philip Marlowe was, and that's kind of their influence in that film, I think.
Well, I can't quite remember the name of the Clooney, George Clooney. I sort of like him. He has a kind of pleasant quality, a little bit like Jimmy Stewart or Gary Cooper, I guess. Mm-hmm. Not a huge fan, except for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, he's wonderful, and Tim Blake Nelson, and there's just wonderful characters in that film, and John Turturro, who's one of their favorite actors, is such a good trio of oddball characters in the South during the Depression. And you know what's great? I think one of the reasons that film became such a favorite was the music is fantastic, isn't it? The bluegrass. And
oh
country.
My gosh, it is thrilling stuff.
Yeah, I got the CD of it at the time. The CD sold like hotcakes, and you know, they have such good taste in American folk music and pop music, and they put that together. You know, like John Ford does that too. He loves American popular music, and there's something really great atmospheric quality about using the music of the period. That's but one thing they do that's interesting that confounds people sometimes is they mix up periods and some facts. For example, Pappy O'Daniel, the governor character in that film, he was actually the governor of another state, but they moved him into Mississippi, and you know, they play around Miller's Crossing. You're never quite sure what city it actually takes place in, and the time period is, it's in the Prohibition era, but it's a little vague, you know. And they Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which I love, Western anthology film that they made for Netflix, at the beginning of the film, Tim Blake Nelson, the singing cowboy, is singing Cool Water, which is a 1936 song that the Sons of the Pioneers made into a big hit. It's really anachronistic. He wouldn't be singing in the Old West, but they don't care because it's a nice song and it fits the tone of the film.
It's fantastic. You know, I think the only other director that used music as effectively was Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, he has a great taste in music. He likes classical music. One reason he did that was he didn't like being dependent on film composers. Like he hired Alex North to do the score of 2001. Then he didn't like the score, so he threw it out. And he was using as temp music as he was cutting the film, and or maybe when he was writing the film with Arthur C. Clarke, he would play classical pieces, and then he would get thinking of them as integral to the visuals. And so, for example, he put on the beautiful Blue Danube with the space station.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. A waltz in the universe. And then, you can't hear the opening of, what is it, Thus Spoke Zarathustra?
Right, right.
Without thinking of that fantastic film.
Yeah, it just is perfect. And there's this timeless quality when you use classical music. You use some modern avant-garde music, too. But to have a standard film score, Alex North, I didn't think was the greatest composer. He did a couple of good scores, but a lot of his scores were kind of simplistic, I thought. And so, but Kubrick didn't like the fact that he would say, write a score, and then the guy would come in like soon before shooting, and there wasn't a lot of chance for him to control it. But he could control, in a sense, the classical music, because he would pick exactly the pieces he wanted, and he would use the greatest orchestras in the world.
So now, you come to the point where you want to write a book about the Coen brothers. Did you get a chance to either talk to either one of the brothers or anybody who worked closely with them? And what was that like?
No, I didn't. John, when I started writing film books, I was writing critical studies back in Wisconsin, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't in California, and I had really very limited access to film people. So I wrote a critical study of Orson Welles for 4 years when I was in college at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Then I wrote a critical study of John Ford with my friend Michael Wilmington, who died recently. And then I moved to California, and I started, you know, having access to people to interview. And I did an interview book with Howard Hawks. For 7 years, I interviewed Hawks, mainly because I wanted to learn from him, because he was such a great storyteller. And I was trying to teach myself screenwriting. And then I realized I had enough to do a book, and I put it together as Hawks on Hawks. But when I left the film industry in 1984, I got tired of being a screenwriter, because they're not treated well in Hollywood. But I decided to write a biography for the first time. Well, I'd written a short biography of Kirk Douglas. I don't exactly put that in the same category as my Frank Capra book, because the Capra book was a very large endeavor. It took 7.5 years, tremendous amount of research, very iconoclastic book. It unmasked him as of kind of a fraudulent figure. His public image doesn't match the reality. So that was a huge project. So I wrote biographies of Capra, Ford, and Spielberg. And frankly, I don't write those anymore, because I can't afford to. They bankrupt you every time you do one. You get an advance, because you need an advance to do a biography. You have to travel a lot, and there are a lot of expenses, and you have to live on it. But it's never enough. And so I was pouring whatever money I had into those books. And I was, when I did the Ford biography, it took about 30 years of research off and on.
Oh my God. I
often work on several projects at the same time, and then one comes closer to fruition. So I began concentrating on Ford. I did 100 magazine articles in the last 2 years of working on the Ford book, which is kind of amazing to me that, you know, I was doing two a week. I don't know how I did that, but I needed to bring in money, and I wrote a television show and things like that. And at the end of it, I was really broke, and I just can't live like that anymore. And it, you know, they don't sell enough. Unfortunately, the problem is film books are not as popular as they used to be, and they were never terribly popular anyway.
Do you think then, in that case, that the Coen brothers' book will do better in Europe than it would here?
Well, that's an interesting thought. The publisher, Anthem Press, is a British company. They also have an American office, but they're basically British. And although the head of the company lives in the United States, but they contacted me. I was going to close the circle on this. After writing biographies, I went back to writing critical studies, which I really enjoy. So I'm going back to my roots. And I did one on Ernst Lubitsch, How Did Lubitsch Do It? And Billy Wilder, a long critical study. And those are where you really immerse yourself in the work. It's not so much biographical as, analysis of the work, and you bring in biographical details, but I don't go out and interview 300 people. So when I did the Coen brothers, I was doing a book called Two Chairs for Hollywood, which is a collection of my short articles over the years. Excuse me. And I wanted to add some new things to it, so it wouldn't just be all older material. So I thought, well, the Coen brothers are kind of misunderstood, and you know, I'd like to write a long piece on them. So I did a 40-page essay on them, a kind of a monograph in the midst of this long book, and that forms the basis for the new book, The Holder in Human Comedy. And Two Cheers for Hollywood has sold pretty well, and you know, it's but the Coen part didn't get a lot of attention because it's, you know, embedded in this several hundred page book. So I kind of thought, well, maybe I should break it out as a complete book and add to it. And then Anthem Press asked me, do you have a book you'd like to write? And I think they said a short book. And I thought, oh, I've always wanted to write a short book. It's, when I was younger, I wrote shorter books. And as I got older, they got longer, because I think you see life in a more complex way, don't you, when you're older, you know? And but I thought, well, yeah, I've got this monograph. And then I wrote a long analysis of The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which I love. And to me, that's a perfect film to write about, to cap off the Coen brothers' work, because it's a compendium of their work. It's six different stories, and it's a range from farcical to, you know, black humor and very grim storytelling. And then there's a more...
Since God bless you for loving to write so much and spending so much of your own money on doing the work that you love to do. Since, you know, you didn't cash large checks, what were some of the most rewarding responses from the writers and the directors about whom you wrote and lauded?
Oh, well, that's interesting. Howard Hawks liked what I wrote about him, although the book came out after his death. I'm trying to think. John Ford wrote me a letter. I did a piece with Mike Wilmington on The Searchers, which helped bring The Searchers into prominence. It was actually kind of forgotten when we wrote about it, and then our piece in Sight and Sound made it a really popular film again. And Ford wrote a note. He had his secretary call me and ask me for a copy of the magazine. And then he said, I appreciate the upbeat, kindly way you treated me. Oh, which was very nice. And I'd written him and I said, I'd like, you know, I'm thinking of doing a biography of you and I'd like, you know, your cooperation. And he said, I'm too old and tired to go in for a biog, even with a McBride. However, let me mull it over, which was kind of remarkable for Ford that he would even mull it over. And then I didn't contact him again. I don't know why. I just thought, well, he's, you know, he was kind of intimidating, and I was not really working hard on the book at that time. But it turned out his grandson, Dan Ford, was doing a biography of him at the same time. And that's one reason he didn't immediately leap at it. But he was grateful for the book, which I appreciated. And
Orson Welles must have absolutely loved you.
Oh, well, yes. Welles, when I met Welles in 1970, I had been, I hadn't quite finished my first book on him, which was published by the British Film Institute in 1972. But I had been putting parts of it in magazines as a way of establishing myself as a Welles expert, and helped me to sell the book. It was a clever idea, and I recommend that to people. And I didn't know where he was. He was always in Europe, but I would mail copies of the magazine articles to his lawyer in New York, Arnold Weisberger, who was the only contact I had for him. And I had no idea if Welles got them, but Weisberger was giving him the articles, and so Welles knew the work. And when I met him, he said, finally, I meet my favorite film critic. And I said,
oh, isn't wow. that fabulous?
I said, why do you say that? And he said, because you're the only one who understands what I'm trying to do, which I thought was really nice.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that wonderful? Did I ever mention to you my review of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore?
No, I don't. I don't know if I know that story.
Oh, well, just I'll tell it quickly in a minute, because I was stunned by what happened. I was on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Mm-hmm. I got $150 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I got $450 a week, and I never signed a contract because they would have owned my material. I didn't want them to own my material. So anyway, I had been a fan. I had seen a short film by Marty Scorsese. It was like a short documentary about an anti-war protester. It was almost never seen. And I happened to love it. So anyway, it was, I'd finished doing my review on a Wednesday. And the next day I heard that Warner Brothers was dumping Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore at the Westwood Theater in Westwood. You know, the part was first offered to Doris Day.
Yeah, I heard that. That's true.
Yeah, and so she turned it down. And the girl who starred in The Exorcist, who was brilliant in it, and then Chris Christopherson is brilliant in it. I mean, really wonderful film. Anyway, I, out of curiosity, I went to see it on Thursday night at the Westwood Theater. There couldn't have been eight people in the theater. And I loved it. And it opened with what looked like a 2-minute homage to The Wizard of Oz.
Right,
that only Marty Scorsese could have done. It was just brilliant. And I loved the movie. So on Friday, I decided I was going to review the film. I junked what else I was going to review. And I happen to say it was by far the greatest woman's movie that I have ever seen. Unfortunately, I saw it by myself. So tomorrow night, which is Saturday night, I'm going to take my wife to the Westwood Theater and we're going to see it. It was a full house on Saturday night. And I always sat in the back row so I could get out quickly, you know. And everybody who came in saw me and said, Johnny, this better be good, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the reaction was so big from that review that Marty called me on the phone. And he said, would you call my bosses at Warner Brothers and tell them to leave in that opening? And I said, Mr. Scorsese, I can't call him Martin, Mr. You know, this is the conflict of interest to me. I loved your movie. I'll make one phone call, but nothing more. So I made the phone call. They decided to release it largely, and it became a monster hit. A month later, he was interviewed by Calendar Magazine in Los Angeles. He devoted a whole page to thanking me for saving his movie.
That's
the joy of sometimes it's like what you're doing now.
It's great though that you can. Yeah, I mean, sometimes critics really have an impact. And I do vaguely remember now that there was some controversy about that ending because it was unusual and jarring. And it's kind of like, remember New York, New York had very sort of unreal, fantastical production design. And Variety's review by Jim Harwood mocked the film for being unreal. He sort of missed the point. And Boris Levin, the production designer, called him up and said, don't you realize we were doing this on purpose? You know, it's like the opening of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. He was doing a fantasy thing that was setting you up for getting the mindset of the woman. But you were the one who helped save that film. That's terrific.
That is beyond rewarding to me. And the other thing is, as a critic, I always enjoyed seeing a film I loved more than one that I didn't like, even though I got bigger laughs if I bombed a film. But, you know, when you can share something wonderful with people, as you do with your books. Now, to me, let's get to me the most frightening villain in all of film history.
I know who you're going to say, yeah.
Go ahead and say
it. Yeah, the fellow in No Country for Old Men who kills people with this bizarre cattle-killing device.
Javier. Oh, my God. You know, I used to think Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. That's really bad, that guy.
Yeah.
But there is no... What's the actor's name? Bardem?
Javier Bardem, yeah.
Yeah, and he does do an excellent job, by the way, in being the Ricardos. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the film?
I haven't seen that yet, actually. I haven't caught up with it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I will tell you this. The guy that plays Fred Mertz, he does these god-awful car commercials.
Mm-hmm.
God, I just wish somebody would forget to put on the brakes and run over the guy. The commercials are horrible. But Aaron Sorkin has written this guy such brilliant dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
He should be a runaway supporting actor winner for an Academy Award. But when you watch the film, which is really, really well done, you will realize that since it was done at the height of the blacklisting, now to me, the shortcoming in the film is Sorkin didn't make it look as horrible as it really was. But if Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball had not been as smart as they were, we would have never heard from them again.
Well, it's interesting, not having seen the film, but Lucy was actually a communist. And that's ironic that back in the 30s, she briefly dallied with communism, as many people did. It was not that unusual. But it came out right at the height of her stardom. And she did a brilliant thing. She was a smart lady, and she played the goofy Lucy character in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Oh, I didn't know what I was doing, and my grandfather got me to sign the petition, and you know, and but I think they sort of said, okay, well, don't do it again. You know, she got away with it. I think partly because she was such a huge moneymaker for CBS, that probably factored into the equation of HUAC allowing her to continue her career, but she expressed regret, et cetera, which you had to do, but she didn't have to name names or anything. She and Desi Arnaz were supportive of Orson Welles, who was blacklisted. I got his FBI files, and he was being hounded by the FBI from the time of Citizen Kane onward because Hearst sick J. Edgar Hoover on him. And Welles, that's why he went to Europe, I realized, and people hadn't focused on that. They thought he went to Europe because his career in Hollywood was in shambles, which was true. But he went there right after those HUAC hearings in the fall of 47 and pretty much stayed away until the about 1956. He went to Hollywood, and Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball put him on I Love Lucy. And then he also directed The Fountain of Youth for them, which is a very innovative TV pilot that unfortunately didn't go to series, but it was a great show. So they were supportive of him. And, you know, I'm fascinated by the blacklist. The guy you were mentioning who plays William Frawley is J.K. Simmons, who's a terrific
actor. That's right. Thank
you. He's one of the Coen brothers' favorites. For example, in Burn After Reading, which I think is a wonderful and underrated film, although it did well at the box office, he plays the head of the CIA, and he's really funny. And there's a great ending scene where he's kind of wrapping it all up in a really hilarious way. And John Malkovich is great as this guy who's a disgraced CIA man who's writing his memoirs that get he loses them, and Francis McDormand and Brad Pitt, who play a couple of idiots, try to sell it to the Russians, who can't understand why they say that this manuscript is drivel, and McDormand thinks the guy is saying dribble. Now, this is an example of the Coen brothers playing with language. But
John is so effective. He almost never speaks above a whisper, but he is so compelling to watch and listen to.
He's a drunk, and he's you know, but it's a funny, goofy, farcical film, but it has some serious underpinnings, like the Coen brothers always do, about the CIA and the kind of nefarious things that they're up to. And then the idea that two people would sell out their country so that Francis McDormand can get plastic surgery is quite funny. John Malkovich calls them a league of morons, which is a phrase that captures a lot of the Coen brothers' characters. They love their morons. They've said, you know, people say we're making fun of these people in a mean way. We're not. We love these characters. We have a lot of affection for them.
There were no morons and no country for old men.
You know what date is on this coin?
No.
1958. It's been traveling 22 years to get here. And now it's here. And it's either heads or tails. And you have to say a coin.
Well, look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything.
How's that?
You stand to win everything, call it.
And my gosh, just tell me a little bit about the impact that movie might have had on you. I mean, that villain was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I was really drawn. I mean, he's so scary and frightening. I mean, there's a great scene toward the end where you remember Kelly MacDonald is in a room with him and she realizes he's going to kill her. And he wants to play a sick game with her life, and she won't play the game. She shows a lot of courage, and then it cuts away, and you know that he's killed her. It's really one of the scariest scenes you've ever seen, but there's no actual violence in it. But the center of the film is Tommy Lee Jones's performance as Ed Tom Bell, who's a lawman with a lot of rectitude, old-fashioned values. You know, his father was a sheriff, and he's what the sad part of the story is, and this is based on the novel by Cormac McCarthy. Ed Tom Bell is a representative of the older values of the Old West, and they're no match for the modern world and serial killers and the kind of evil that's running around the world today. He just admits that he can't cope with it. He has no way of handling it, and it's a very sad film. The ending is really great, where he tells a dream that he had. He's retired, and he talks to his wife, and he said, "I had this dream," and he talks about his dead father, and in the dream, he's going to see his dead father. He's going on horseback, and it's a dream about his own mortality and about the values his father held and how they're elusive, and they're all gone. It's a very bleak look at America, but there is a moron in the film, which is the character played by Josh Brolin, who at the beginning of the film, he's the guy we're focused on, and he comes upon a drug deal gone bad with a bunch of dead bodies, and he picks up a suitcase full of money, you remember, and that was a fatal mistake, because, you know, if you see that kind of scene, get the heck out of there. But he tampers with it, and so they're after him all through the film, and that's where Javier Bardem comes in. He's trying to pursue him, so you have this guy who's sort of a likable shit kicker, everyman kind of guy, but he makes this fatal mistake, which a lot of the Coen characters do, such as the guy in Fargo is analogous. He's a lovable idiot, but he makes this awful mistake by hiring these two hitmen. It's the kind of thing that you and I wouldn't do, but, you know, it's a cautionary tale of what can happen if we make a horrible mistake in life, you know.
Well, they were so brilliant, because in the scene on the highway when he has to get another car or something, and he takes out his contraption, and he does it in somebody and takes over the car, so we know how just horribly vicious and unfeeling he is. But there is a scene in a small store.
Oh, yes, that's a great scene.
And I think he takes out a coin.
Yeah, I was alluding to that when I mentioned Kelly MacDonald won't play this game with the guy, but the game was played with this store man who's a small part actor. And he's playing a game with a coin for his life. In other words, like, if you win the game, I'll spare your life. It's really sick. And he winds up killing the guy. And it just shows how, as you say, he's completely heartless. He's almost like a machine or an inhuman character.
You know what it was?
You can't kill him at the end either. He keeps going on.
Yeah. It's heads I win, tails you lose.
Yeah.
You don't see him kill him, but Jesus, you just feel, oh my God, this. And then you're right, he gets stomped all over at the end and keeps on going.
Yeah, and you know, when I first saw it, I kind of thought, well, that device that he uses is kind of so bizarre that I thought this is a little too bizarre. But then I realized it's sort of symbolic of, you know, it's about killing cattle. And that's what they did in the Old West, or even the modern West. They had to kill off their cattle for food, and it is adapting a device which has become mechanized. In the old days, they would shoot or otherwise kill the cattle with low-tech devices, but now it's become high-tech, and so it sort of fits that it's a modern Western way of killing that is so high-tech you can't defeat it, and it's extremely surreal almost, isn't it, the way he kills people with that thing.
Oh, amazing. Now, you're being a member of the Academy and all the other things you have and all the awards you've gotten. I'm sure you probably got a DVD of Macbeth.
Well, I'm a member of the American Cinema Editors, actually, and I'm also a member of the Writers Guild, although I'm retired from the Writers Guild, so I don't get their DVDs, but I get them because I'm a member of the American Cinema Editors. I was surprised they made me a member. I wrote an article for their magazine, and they liked it so much, they made me an honorary member, I guess because I'm a film historian, which was very nice. I love editors, you know. So,
well, if there are any of those films that you don't get, because like you, I'm still a member of the Writers Guild and after SAG and all of that, so I get them all the time. If you ever run out of DVDs to look at, just give me a call.
Yeah.
I can't watch them all. But have you seen the Macbeth?
Yes, I like that very much. That came out after I finished my manuscript on the Coens. And, you know, I wrapped it up with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And then, you know, it takes a few months to go through the production process. And then Joel Coen, I knew he was making the Macbeth film, but I hadn't seen it until the fall. It played at the New York Film Festival and it played in Europe. But I hadn't seen it until late fall. So I wrote a note to the reader saying, okay, bear in mind that they are not working together for a while. And I quoted Carter Burwell, who's their favorite composer, is saying, well, we don't really know what they plan to do. They don't know what they plan to do. And Ethan is off on his own, and maybe they'll get back together and make films. He said they have a bunch of scripts that they've written that hopefully will get filmed.
Well, with Macbeth, I must tell you, I am so glad they shot it in black and white.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Because, oh my gosh, it so suits it. And I am really surprised and impressed at how good Denzel Washington was.
Yeah, he's done Shakespeare on the stage, and he's just a great actor too. And it was a really good take on the story. You know, it's very similar in some ways to Orson Welles' Macbeth, which that's an interesting film. It was made on Republic Pictures sound stages. Low budget studio. It was the only studio in Hollywood that would make a Shakespeare film, and it was low budget. And people derided the film when it came out because it was very stylized sets and. But, you know, now we look at that film and it is superb. And Joel Coen said he was inspired by it. It's similar to what they did. That film, the Welles' film, I didn't like for a while. And it turned out that the studio had cut a lot of it and they redubbed the soundtrack because they said people couldn't understand the Scottish dialect. But actually, well, what happened was Richard Wilson, who was Welles' right-hand man, managed to restore the film with Robert Gitt of UCLA in 1980, and they put the film back the way it was originally. With there's one, the murder scene of the king is fantastic. It's a 10-minute take. It's astonishing, kind of like Hitchcock was doing with Rope, but even better. But it's all a tremendous tension, you know, when you don't cut the camera, and it's at the foot of the stairs, and Lady Macbeth is waiting, and her husband kills the king and comes down, and Welles has several camera movements. It's just brilliant, and the soundtrack is wonderful, and it's very intelligible. Welles said, actually, the Scottish dialect slows down the rhythm of speech, and it's actually more intelligible. The only one problem I had watching Joel Coen's film is I kept hearing the line readings of Welles' version a little bit.
You know,
I had to keep clearing my head of that and watch it anew because McDormand and Washington are so good, but they're different. You know, it's a different take. I mean, Macbeth has been the subject of several good films. Polanski made a good one. Kurosawa made a good one, you know.
Yes, indeed. And yet when I saw a really interesting interview, was it Joel who made it? Not Ethan, was Joel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joel made it.
He did it was an extended interview he did by himself with Denzel Washington, then the wonderful actress who played Lady Macbeth, and then there was another actress, I think, who played all the witches. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, she was amazing. She was amazing.
But the first thing I said to my wife, I said, you know, they're going to have to hire another black actor. And my wife said, why? Well, they can't have a white Macduff killing Denzel Washington. They're going to have a black Macduff killing. So there it was. But the movie, was really compelling. And, you know, I don't know that Denzel will win the award, but my God, he did a wonderful job.
Well, they're superb. And Catherine Hunter is the woman you mentioned, played the three witches through camera magic. And she's kind of a contortionist, and she's a brilliant stage actress, but she's very unusual, and she's astonishing in that role. And
Like watching Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah. I mean, she is kind of like a circus performer. The cast is uniformly good. And I like to, you know, the mixed casting, mixed race casting, or the colorblind casting, as they call it, is actually fairly common in Shakespeare productions on stage. And Denzel Washington was in a film, a Shakespeare film that Kenneth Branagh made a few years ago. And but I think that, you know, instead of just having one black performer, they had a number of them. And yes, it sort of makes it seem like not an unusual thing or not an issue. And that's, I think, part of what was the thinking involved. Just have good actors play the parts.
Everyone blended in perfectly. I mean, they were all human beings. It was very, very, very good. Okay, now, one of the things that I want to do, you mentioned the end scene of No Country for Old Men. It's probably 2 or 3 minutes long.
Yeah, the dream. He's telling his wife the dream, yeah.
Yeah, because what I would like to do to augment this, I mean, aside from showing the great, I love the cover of your book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And that actor, why did you pick that actor?
Oh, here it is, The Holder in Human Company. Sam Elliott, he plays what's called the stranger in Big Lebowski. He's the narrator of the film, and he has this kind of wry cowboy narration. Again, the cowboy motif. The Coens are having fun with the Western motif. They think of Hollywood as the West. You know, they're guys from, they live in New York and they're from the Midwest. So Hollywood is kind of like the Far West, which it is. And so he starts out with tumbleweeds blowing through the hills of Los Angeles, and you see the lights of LA, and then it goes to the dude who lives apparently, I guess, in Venice, California, you know. But the narrator pops up occasionally at the bowling alley, and he's got this wry sense of humor, but he's referring to the dude as kind of a hero. He said, you know, what's a hero? He's a hero. But he's talking about this. The whole darn human comedy is represented in this film. He gives you an attitude toward it that the Coens often have framing devices in their stories of one kind or another, and they like narration, which Billy Wilder loved narration too. And Wilder's rule in narration was, don't have the narrator tell you what we're watching. That's redundant. Have him add an attitude, have him add something. Like Sunset Boulevard is a fabulous use of narration. A dead screenwriter narrates from the swimming pool where he's floating. It's a wonderful way of letting him rewrite his life as a movie.
I just wanted to interrupt you a minute because you're talking about heroes. You know what? Because I mentioned Red Fox was my mentor when I started as a comic.
Oh, was he really? Yeah.
Yeah, and one of my only lifelong friends in the business.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, I was the first one to put him on variety television, which led to Sanford. And that's his real name, John Sanford.
Yeah. And so you helped him get that boost there. That's great.
Yeah. So anyway, in any event, he heard me talking often about Jim Garrison. And he says, because I called Jim a hero, and he said to me, John, heroes ain't born. They're cornered.
That's a good phrase.
And that's it, because Garrison, as you know, was cornered by accidentally meeting the only dissenting member of the Warren Commission, Hale Boggs.
Who said,
you know, he couldn't have fired that. So anyway, give me a couple of that scene I would like to add to this to enhance the value of your wonderful interview. Could you think of another scene that you might want me to include in this?
Could I just give you a little side thing on Red Fox? I can't resist telling you my little connection with Red Fox. It didn't quite work out. But when I moved to Hollywood, I was writing scripts, and I wrote five before I wrote one that was any good. And I wrote an original script that I wanted to make Red Fox a movie star. I thought this guy was so good. I loved his blue records, they called them, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The Chitlin' Circuit nightclub, black nightclub records. They were really raunchy extremely raunchy, hilarious records. I thought this guy is a brilliant comedian. So I wrote a serial comic film about an old man who's a model citizen, his last day on the job at age 65, and he kind of goes berserk through a series of problems that happen, and he cuts loose. And it was a good script, and I wrote it with Red Fox in mind, and I got to Hollywood, and I tried to get it to Fox, and nobody would, you know, the agents weren't interested in him because, you know, I said this guy should be a movie star, but they, you know, they didn't know who he was or whatever. And finally, I met Red Fox at some Hollywood event. He was surrounded by a bunch of guys. He had already by that time become a star in Sanford and Son, but he still hadn't cracked into the film business. And he said, yeah, I'll read it. Send it to me. And I sent it to him. And I'm still waiting for a response, unfortunately. I learned a lesson. Don't write a script that only one actor could do. What I should have done was rewritten it for other black actor comedians.
It's a great idea for a movie, but I must tell you, sadly, even though he was, as a matter of fact, you may remember when he was getting $25,000 an episode for Sanford. And he kept calling Bjork and Lear the Jews weren't generous enough to him. Oh. You may recall that he was complaining that he didn't have a window in his dressing room.
Well, I remember he was causing some issues, yeah.
Yeah, well, his dressing room was in the basement. What's he want a window for? To look at a parking lot, for God's sake? Well, when he left NBC to hide, he came to our house. That's where he was. And I helped him write the contract that got him to leave Norman, which I wish he'd never done, and he went to agency and he bombed. But sadly, success went to his nose.
Well, I felt that. I mean, I felt that he didn't handle success well, you know, because he became this big TV star. It was a great show, Sanford and Son, but then, as you say, you know, personality issues came into fore, and he kind of blew it. And then he never made it as a film star. He made a bad movie called Norman Is That You, which was actually filmed on videotape, and it was kind of a dumb play.
That was George Slaughter.
Yeah, that was not a good entry into film. So he bungled his chance to be a movie star. But, you know, part of it was Hollywood. They didn't know how to handle an older guy who's a black entertainer who was unique like Red Fox.
Yeah, but the problem was he didn't know how to handle himself.
Yeah, no, it's hard.
I must tell you, you know, Sinatra at one time was going to kill himself. I mean, that's how bad and far down he got.
Yeah.
And yet he knew how to hold himself together.
Well, he came out of the old studio system. And, you know, I've talked to people like Jimmy Stewart said, you know, the old studio system was great for actors because they you know, they kind of controlled their careers and they had a sense of what roles they're good for. And today the actors are all on their own and they often make bad choices. And Stewart also said, you know, if you weren't acting in a film, that you'd be getting fencing lessons or dancing lessons or singing lessons or whatever. There was something about the old system that, you know, gave people a longer and more coherent career. But a lot of good people self-destructed like Red Fox did. And that's a sad thing. But, you know, he should have done my script. What can I say? But, you know, it shows why I like the Coen brothers, because it was a mixture of zany comedy and some dark stuff. Actually, it got a little too dark. Some people said there was a scene in there where he kills a dog. And I realized, oh, yeah, you shouldn't have your hero kill a dog. I could have had him just sort of – I was thinking he should have fed the dog some soap or something where foam would come out of the mouth. It would have been funny, but he wouldn't be dead.
Oh, my God. Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
You remember Sam?
Oh, I went out to drink with him the night of Orson Welles' AFI Life Achievement Award. Somehow I wound up afterwards in a
Mexican
restaurant with Sam Peckinpah and Ray Bradbury. Oh, that's the whole story in itself.
I had reviewed Getaway, and I said to compliment, and I complimented a couple of scenes, and I said, but to compliment just a couple of scenes in this movie is like complimenting Tijuana for the one toilet that flushes. Well, he called the most, he was drunk, he was gonna cut off my head and piss down my throat. But I had tried to explain to him that he did one of the best westerns ever made called The Westerner with Brian Keith.
Oh, that series, yeah, that's great.
In the 50s, and I saw it as a kid, and I fell in love with this scene because you said the killing of the dog. Brian Keith is out in the desert, and there's no water around, and he's got a little pouch, and he shakes it, and you hear there are a couple of drops of water left there, and the camera looks down at his dog who's got his tongue out and panting at his knees like that.
Yeah.
You think, oh, well, the guy's going to give the dog the water. He pushes the dog away and drinks the water. So
yeah.
I told Sam, I said, that's what I fell in love with, was that Beckinpah. So.
Well, he was, you know, an erratic talent, but a genius. And Getaway was pretty good, although Ally McGraw can't act, unfortunately.
No, she cannot.
Yeah,
she
but, can't. You know, there's Stephen Queen was a great actor, and there's some terrific scenes in there. And but, you know, Peckinpah was another guy who unfortunately self-destructed. But before he did, he made some really great films.
Oh,
but God. The Coens, you know, I think one reason that I like them is they've sustained a good long career. And actually, an interesting point came up recently when Joel was asked about their hiatus. This is after my book was finished. He said, well, you know, Ethan didn't want to work on McGraw's, but I'm not sure we'll work together. But they admitted they never planned to work together as brothers as long as they did. They didn't sit there and say when they were young guys, we're going to be a brother team and work together our whole lives.
Now, you know why it worked out? Because it's a happy accident.
Yeah, it's a happy accident. They said we just sort of fell into it and we kept working together and it worked out fine. But they're individuals too. And, you know, we'll see more of, you know, what defines each. There is kind of one reason I think the critics have had a hard time pigeonholing them. Part of it is they don't like being pigeonholed and they defy it. But they're not, it's not just one filmmaker. If it's one filmmaker, you can get a handle on him or her like you do Peckinpah or Orson Welles or whatever, but with two guys, it's hard to know where one ends and one begins because they really work together as directors and writers and producers. And, they, you know, as any good collaboration, you know, you can't separate the two. It's because they're working in harmony together. And also their scripts are so beautifully written.
They're fabulous. So
they're like Billy Wilder. I'll just say they insisted on the actors doing the lines the way they were written to no improvisation.
Absolutely. So, what are you thinking of doing next? So give us the last word and what you
well,
think.
Well, that's a good question. I just did four books that came out in a brief period. I did one on the Kennedy assassination called Political Truth, the Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy, which I've been working on off and on for a long time. And it's a
and in the fall, you and I are going to spend another hour or so on that.
That would be great. I know you and I share that as one of our main interests. That's actually my major interest in life. I'd say films are secondary, oddly enough, even though that's been my career. And I did an updated version of my book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career. And I did the Billy Wilder book, which is a big, long project. And so I'm kind of taking a little breather and hiatus right now to think about what I might do next. And I don't really have a concrete plan, and I'm going to take it easy for a little while. But, you know, when you come out with books, you do, they let you out of the cage for a while. That's because you're trapped in your room writing for years, and then they let you out for a month or two to talk about the books, and it's fun. You get to talk to people like you, and that's kind of the reward, the cherry on top.
Well, I got to leave you with my favorite quote about writing, and it's in my book, and that's Dorothy Parker. Dorothy Parker said, I hate writing, but I loved having written.
Right. She also did a version of that. She said, most people in Hollywood don't want to write. They want to have written. And that is so true. You know, you go to parties with people and they say, no, you know, I wrote a book once, and, you know, they live on that for the rest of their lives. But I'm a working writer and I like to write. I mean, that's the motor that keeps me going. I've been doing this since May of 1963. And it's unusual for me not to be working on a book. But you know,
well, so to me, I'm absolutely thrilled that you're writing because I love the reading of your writing.
Thank you, John.
And the title of the book again is?
The Whole Dern Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again.
There's nobody that I enjoy talking movies with more than I do you.
That's so nice to hear. Thank you. Well, you're fun to talk to, John.
Thanks. Okay. We will meet again in the fall.
Oh, I'd love to. Anytime. It's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The next talking movies may be one of the most important and most interesting that we have ever done. In that show, Donald Jeffries and Leno Sanek of Black Op Radio out of Vancouver, Canada, and I are going to assemble half a dozen of the most important and the most profound and the most perfect films ever made about the murder of John Kennedy and Jim Garrison's solved investigation. It will be an absolutely must-watch show. And so, till then, good luck.